hanging on. So in many ways, they've been against God. So revenge is about to come. We saw the altar in chapter 6 and 8, a regular fixture here. Turns. If you don't know what these altars look like, I got a whole picture. Here's a picture. Tonight we're going to finish chapter 9, which is the first half of it a couple weeks ago. And here we'll see the blowing of the sixth trumpet, which will mark the final, the ultimate end of the Roman Empire. And what we've been looking at, and really since the chapter 3, we've been looking at world history, the major events, the things that would impact the world in which the church lives. We saw the fall of paganism, the fall of Rome itself as the capital of the Roman Empire, moved to Constantinople. Then when we fifth trumpet, first part of chapter 9, we saw Muslims move through, take the southern portion of the Roman Empire. The west had already fallen. That was the first four trumpets. And so now we're to the point where all that's left, Constantinople and the area surrounding it, there's still a fair amount of territory, but nothing compared to what it had been previously at its height. We're now at a point in time. The last thing we saw was in 783 when the peace treaty was signed with the Muslims. But there's another force that is going to come through now and finish the last vestige of the Roman Empire. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God. The sixth angel sounds, and he hears a voice. John does. The voice is not the voice of the angel. We'll see that in the next verse, where we see this voice giving directions to the angel. The voice, it says, comes from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God. The altar, of course, was used for sacrifice. I think that's significant here. We saw back in chapter 7, I believe it was, where those who had been slain for the cause of Christ cried out, "How long, O Lord, basically, do you avenge us?" He's about to do that. This is to be the final and ultimate blow against a power that in different ways has persecuted God's people. Third and early fourth centuries, there were periods of great persecution directly from the Roman Empire. Of course, even from its inception, the church was persecuted by the Jews. Of course, the Romans allowed that. So, in many ways, they have been very guilty of persecuting God's people. And then they have embraced a form of Christianity that is not of God and basically made it their religion from the time of Constantine on. So in many ways, they've been against God. So revenge is about to come. We saw the altar in chapter 6 and 8, a regular fixture here. Burns. If you don't know what the altars look like, I got a couple pictures of typical altars. We don't know exactly what the one looked like John saw, but I would say similar, if not exactly like the one that was in the temple. But again, we don't have pictures of that. But the horns were used to tie the victim to. Picture. You can just see that the horns, protrusions at the corner, something you can tie to. Didn't know. Just saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound to the great river Euphrates. Now, this voice, whoever's speaking, tells the sixth angel that has the trumpet to loose these four angels. Just because it says angel doesn't mean it's something good. Angel simply means messenger. Now, they're bound to the great river Euphrates. That's going to tell us something about the part of the world they're coming from. Going to symbolize some force that's going to come against what is now called the Byzantine Empire and is going to overcome it and ultimately destroy it. Because it says angels doesn't mean good. For God spared not the angels of sin to cast them down to hell and deliver them into chains of darkness to reserve unto judgment. So, first of all, not all angels are good. And secondly, the word angel doesn't always mean an angelic being. Muslims have tried twice. Had Constantinople, capital of the empire, and failed. strength, and from there they're only going to make their push into the Byzantine Empire. And the four angels were loose, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of men. This verse right here would be 20 years. This verse, as I began studying Revelation many moons ago, always bothered me. And I'll tell you the first thing that was a red flag. The typical interpretation of this verse, and the description, which is what we're taking, is that this represents a period of 396 years and 4 months. Now, we can do the math here using the idea of a day per year. If you've got an entire year, that comes into question initially. It said that, well, you can't use 360 years. Because it's so specific, it goes beyond the value of a year, you've got to use 365 and a quarter. Well, that's inconsistent, first of all. Because everywhere else we use 360. That bothers me. I can see the rationale, but it still bothers me. A month would be 30 days or 30 years. A day would be 1 year. An hour would be a 12th of a day or 1 month. And so we've come up 396 years and 4 months. The end point was never in doubt. The fall of Constantinople, May 29, 1453. Back that up, you come to late January of 1057. Well, I've been looking at history. I even asked Dana a few years ago to do some looking. And he looked. It never made sense. Because what is said, and you could go right now, you could find commentaries, open it up, they mention it. You could find commentaries online, they'll talk about it. That, and it seems like there's two dates, January 19th and January 28th and 29th. 10 force, an army, marched across the Euphrates River, invaded the Byzantine Empire, and there began the long campaign that would last 396 years and 4 months until Constantinople fell. There's just one tiny little problem with this whole scenario. I'm no expert on history by far. There's a couple of areas that I've studied in Revelation I've got pretty good at, though. And what we're looking at here are the Ottoman Turks. They're the ones who ultimately are going to destroy Constantinople. They had their beginnings, the Turks did, in the area of, as an empire, the area of Baghdad. There's a man by the name of Seljuk, who in the 1020s, 1030s, began to amass some power and some followers. Ultimately, his son, Togrul Beg, came into Baghdad around 1055. Seized control of Baghdad, and then moved on somewhere else, building an empire in that part of the world. While he was gone, there was an uprising. His people were overthrown. So he had to come back in there about 1058, 1059, and retake Baghdad. And so he's still really establishing control on the other side of the Euphrates when supposedly his forces should have already crossed and invaded the Byzantine Empire. They didn't do anything until after his death. He died in 1062. His nephew, Alp Arslan, took over, and he began some small incursions. But it wasn't until 1067 that the first major battle was fought between the Byzantine Empire and the Turks. So they did not, in any significant way, cross the Euphrates River in 1057 and invade the Byzantine Empire. It just, if they did, it's lost to history. Because, and I always knew something was wrong because all of these historical facts, you can think of an encyclopedia or any typical history book and find them. But they're obvious. This was not obvious because it wasn't there. About 4 or 5 weeks ago, I actually did something smart for a change. I realized I wasn't smart enough to figure this out. I did some praying one night. And about 2 nights later, I figured the answer out. The Lord gave me the answer, I should say. And realized that this verse is not what it seems. It is not representing a time period. I'll try to show you how we know that. 53. Now, there's a few time periods mentioned in Revelation that we do know represent time periods, and we can fit those very exactly. And chapter 2, verse 10, it says, "You shall have tribulation 10 days." That corresponds to the 10-year period of persecution under Diocletian from 303 to 313. Earlier in this chapter, we saw tormented 5 months, the Muslims, from 633 until 783, made advances and were persecuting and tormenting the Byzantine Empire, took away a good part of it. And then we're going to see four references. Holy City be fed underfoot 40 and 2 months. All these last 40 refer to the same period of time, 1,203 score days. 1,203 score days, and again, 42 months. All a 1,260-year period of time that we'll get to fairly soon. Now, as we look at all these, we're going to compare it to verse 15 here, and there's going to be something that's going to really stick out. But we've got to do something to make it stick out. We've got to look at the Greek. If you've ever studied a foreign language, something probably jumped out at you real quick. They get their words all backwards. At least it doesn't seem like it. Other languages, I know Spanish almost always the case, but in most of the cases I've seen, the noun comes first, then the adjective. You know, we do just the opposite in English. I'd say that Ashley has on a pink shirt. But in Spanish, you normally say shirt, and then you describe it. You can't generally get a simple word-for-word translation. Quite often there's not a word for a given word in another language, and they're in different orders, so it's going to be scrambled around. But let's notice something. As we go back and look at chapter 2, literally the word that from Greek is translated day is first, then the word is translated 10. We're doing the same thing. The type of period, and then the number. Same verse 5 of this chapter. Months, 5. Months, 42 days, 1,206 days, 1,260, 42. All of them are consistent in that pattern. Whatever kind of period it is, month, day, whatever comes first, then the number. Now, if you take what is in this verse here we're looking at, 950, and you look at the order of those Greek words and just translate them straight into English in that order, you get this. Hour and day and month and year. It's completely different. It was at the point that I saw this, I said, okay, starting to make sense. It's not what I have been looking at, thinking about. And again, the old preconceived notion. What I have heard Brother Harry say, and what I've read elsewhere, and it took me 20 years to realize that I was wrong. What is that verse really saying? Quite often it helps to look at other translations. The King James isn't wrong here. It's just that it can be misleading in the way it's worded. And that's so often the case with any translation you look at. So just change one little word slightly or do something, and it can lead you in a different direction if you're not careful. Here's the NIV, which I don't care for at all, but look how they translate it. And the four angels who have been kept ready for this very hour and day and month and year. For this. And there is an article there in the Greek. The example Z, but it's there. And that's important. We'll use it in a minute. I think I've got it right there. And loosed were the four messengers who had been made ready for the hour and day and month and year, that they may kill the third part of man. And the four angels were loosed, which had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year. So the four angels who were ready for that hour, day, month, and year were released. The four angels were released for this very hour, of this very day, of this very month and year. They had been kept ready to kill a third of all the human race. Begin to see what it's saying? It's not at all saying that they were going to operate over this period of time. And if you think about what we're leading up to here, it makes sense. This is it. This is the end of the Roman Empire. This is not one of the steps. This is finality. And so when the final blow is struck, he's saying here that this force had been prepared, not just to maybe come along sometime or another and accomplish this, but God had planned the very year, the month, the day, and the hour it was going to happen. So it's not a time period at all, but it's telling us how exact God is in doing the things he does. He prepared them and knew what they were going to do, when they were going to do it, how they were going to do it. The fact that the Roman Empire, the last part of fell, wasn't haphazard. God planned it, he took care of it. He loved his people. To slay the third part of men, once again, the Roman Empire was in three parts. The western part fell with the first four trumpets, the southern part with the fifth trumpet, and now the eastern part is going to fall with the third, sixth trumpet. Four angels. What could that possibly mean? Well, if we look at history, we can find out fairly quickly. And the western and northwestern parts of their empire began to divide and were supplanted soon after the death of Mahmud by the family of another Turkish chieftain named Seljuk, fresh from the wild life of the steppes, whom Mahmud unwisely had invited to settle in a portion of his domain. Very soon the Seljuks were lords where they came as guests. At the end of the year 1050, Toghrul Beg, grandson of their first leader, was in Baghdad, master of the caliphate itself. Two successors of Toghrul Beg, his nephew, Alp Arslan, and Malik Shah, Alp Arslan's son, wrested from the Byzantine Empire the greater part of Asia Minor, which appears to have been at that time the most highly civilized part of the world. From the ruin they spread over that country, it has never risen since. At Alp Arslan's death in 1092, his dominion embraced nearly all that now belongs to Asiatic Turkey, together with the whole of Persia and Bukhara. But civil war followed, which broke it into four parts. And in the next century, the Seljuk dynasty was overthrown. We've looked at the rise of the Seljuk Turk dynasty, but after three leaders, internal strife, it broke into four pieces, and it was one of those, the Ottoman Turks, who would go on eventually to bring down Constantinople. That's the meaning of the four angels. In fact, it breaks into four parts. The number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, and I heard the number of them. Well, they certainly wouldn't have been able to count it. That's 200 million. Think about that. There's maybe a couple of countries right now that somebody's imagination could potentially field an army of that size, maybe China and India. And even come close to having the resources to truly equip and field an army that size. No one back in that day could have. Wouldn't have the manpower or the resources. So we're not looking at an army truly of this size. But it's kind of like the locust representing the Muslims, this huge overspreading force. The idea here, I think, is this is an army, it may as well be that large. God has already determined what they're going to do. And when you look at it from a historical perspective, they achieved something truly significant, something that many, many armies had tried. Constantinople has the distinction, historically, as being the most often besieged city. Armies came, they tried, they gave up, they went home. This was the one who would finally do it. He says, I heard the number of them, so apparently the angel told me. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire and of jacinth and brimstone, and the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. Bad characters. But if you look at, there's something mentioned here, three things, mentioned twice. The fire, jacinth, which we'll see in a minute what it is, and brimstone. The breastplate to a soldier was an indispensable piece of equipment. With arrows and spears and whatever else flying around, that would protect the vital organs of the body. That was something the soldier desperately needed. He probably wouldn't last long. Jacinth means deep blue, and it really means smoke. It's synonymous with smoke in the latter part of the verse. So fire, smoke, brimstone. Not a real nice situation to look like. Brimstone, Strong says, sulfurous. Now, if you've ever been someplace like Yellowstone National Park, and the name there, Yellowstone, sulfur is yellow, the first European explorers in that part of the world, they were amazed at what they saw. You got all these places where you've got steam and hot gases and things coming out of the earth, and usually you can smell it as soon as you can see it. A lot of sulfur. Most things that stink have sulfur in them somewhere. gap is about cool. And so it's around the brim of the holes. It's brim stalk. And the name comes from. But it's associated with what's really being talked about here, and that's gunpowder. Again, two places in the verse, fire, smoke, sulfur, and out of their mouths. What is John seeing here? Something that he couldn't tell us what it is. He'd never seen it. Nobody would see it for over 1,000 years after his death. But something that by the time Constantinople fell, it had become, it was still fairly new, but instrumental in trying to bring down a walled city. And it made walled cities obsolete. You know, we don't put walls in our cities anymore. They're too easy to bring down. And that day, not only was the breastplate, the armor important, but so was the horse. You lost your mount, and with all these soldiers riding on horseback, you know, you were out of luck. You're probably going to get stomped pretty quick. But what John was really seeing was cannon. Something that was very new at that time, but this was the first army that would come against Constantinople with something that could actually bring down the walls. They had proven impossible for other armies to breach, get over, get through, get under, but now somebody could actually come and bring the walls down. After their last unsuccessful attempt, it said that several generations elapsed before the Muslims appeared again before the walls of Constantinople, which always proved too thick and too strong for the Arabs to penetrate without the aid of gunpowder. Now, when you fired a cannon in the 15th century, it wasn't like what you might think of today. Today, gunpowder is what is termed smoke. The gunpowder they used then would generate lots of smoke. You would know it if somebody fired, even if you didn't hear it. Smokeless powder was invented in about 1884. By the 1900s, it's about all that was used. That's pretty messy. The earliest artillery was used chiefly against the walls and gates of besieged towns, forts, and castles. The Hundred Years' War, in which the English kings tried to add France to their kingdom, made the battlefields a proving ground for the new science of artillery. The first great land battle of that war, at Crecy in 1346, is most remembered because it proved English archers superior to heavily armored knights on horseback. It was also at Crecy that King Edward III of England introduced cannons, short-barreled bombards. Cannon proved their value in the ensuing siege of Calais, which Edward conquered after 11 months. In 1436, King Charles VII of France organized the first permanent artillery department for purposes of siege and defense, and headed it with a master of artillery. At the other end of Europe, the Turks under Mohammed II used much artillery, some of great size, in their siege of Constantinople in 1453. Their conquest brought about the final downfall of the Eastern Roman Empire and the establishment of Constantinople as the new capital of the Turkish or Ottoman Empire. So this reference makes mention of how important and instrumental having the cannon was to the success of the Turks. Constantinople is said to be the world's most often besieged city. It has stood, if you think about this in context, since 330, Constantine moved the capital there. It had stood as the capital of the empire. Things had changed. Much of the empire was lost. Still, over 1,000 years, the city stood there. Over 20 armies, it is said, had besieged that city and tried to take it. Good. And you know, we think sometimes about our country and how long we've been here. A fifth of how long Constantinople was here. There's an excellent description. I'm not one of those guys who sits down and start reading history and just get so engrossed in it, I can't put it down. But this was the case with this one. Called the destruction of the Greek Empire. The general assault commenced between 1 and 2 hours after midnight on the morning of Tuesday, May 29th. The battle continued through the night with not much success. But the Turks, having superior numbers, continued to throw fresh boots at the defenders, which had now been harassed for weeks. Mohammed had even begun the initial attack that night with his worst and therefore most expendable troops. When they were driven back, he sent a fresh wave toward the wall. Finally, sensing a moment of weakness in the opposition, Mohammed ordered his best troops, the Janissaries, which he had kept in reserve, to join the attack. The weakness which Mohammed had spotted was due to the wounding of General Jacinta. have it saw that his great effort had succeeded, where Arabs with even greater numbers than he commanded, and the first flush of the victorious career of Islam, to the presence of the great Diyoub, the companion of the prophet, to encourage them and to speak of the wondrous rewards which paradise had in store for believers who should enter new Rome or die in the attempt, where Murad 30 years before and where 20 other besieging armies had been unable to capture the world's capital, he had succeeded. Seated on horseback beneath his great standard and insignia, he watched with the legitimate pride of a conqueror the entry of his forge into the city. The morning sun shed its rays upon him and his standard as the soldiers thronged through the gate of the assault or hastened toward that of Adrianople. The entry was not long after sunrise and probably between 5 and 6 o'clock. And thus ended, after more than 1,500 years of dominating that part of the world, the Roman Empire. By these was the third part of men killed, by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. Their mouths. Think of a cannon. You look at it, I don't know what it is. See this opening. To him, it's a mouth. And he sees all this fire and smoke coming out of it. I mean, he's giving a pretty good description of a cannon, not even knowing what it was. And it was this, obviously, that caused Kirk to be able to do what others in the past had not been able to do, to overcome Constantinople. The fire and the smoke and the brimstone issued from their mouths. The mightiest of empires. Historically, that's definitely true. It seems like Rome's gone. You have a revelation of that. Rome's not done yet. First in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents, and had head, and with them they do herd. Horse in their mouth. That's where the fire, the cannonball, that was the business end. That's where the damage came from. Their tails were like unto serpents. Some sort of fuse they were lighting. It would look almost like a tail coming out of it. And with them they do herd. That's what they used to bring down the city. Horse in the mouth. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils, and idols of gold, and silver, and brass, and stone, and of wood, which neither can see, nor hear, nor walk. He's talking not about the empire, but the people. Piece by piece, over time, he has dismantled the Roman Empire, God has. No doubt hoping that many would see his hand in it, his hand against the empire, and what it stood for, and the religion of it, even though it was supposedly Christian, and might repent. But they didn't. Now, you can see that the major accusation here, worshiping the works of their hands, devils, idols. Many, many times God has told his people not to worship anything but him. And has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, which I have not commanded. And served other gods and worshiped them, gods whom they knew not, and whom he had not given unto them. Their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. Thy images also will I cut off, and thy standing images out of the midst of thee. And thou shalt no more worship the work of thine hands. Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, full of idols, images, they are idolaters. There are two ways to put it. They're idolaters. They do the very thing that God chastised Israel and punished Israel for over and over and over again. Some might say, what's the difference? You know, these aren't images of some other god, Baal or something like that. Well, that's true. Are there images of people who aren't even God? They pray to them and worship them essentially. The Catholic Church prays to and worships certain saints. You may have heard of Hail Marys. Those are prayers asking for the intercession of Mary, the mother of Jesus, on their behalf or something. Now, if you notice, when the wise men were coming to the house, they saw the young child Mary with his mother and fell down and worshiped him, not them. They didn't worship Mary. No one in the Bible did. But yet suddenly, probably, you know, nearly as many prayers go to Mary as they do Jesus himself. Apostle Peter is also worshipped. It's said that there is a painting in St. Peter's Basilica that passersby walk by and they can kiss the feet of it, and as soon as they get kissed, it's the paint's gone in that area. Peter be worshipped? He didn't think so. And as Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter said to him up, saying, "Stand up. I myself am also a man." He'd been mistaken here. Or maybe this is before he became the first pope. Couldn't make mistakes in poking and fouling. He made several of them. But I guess it's before he became pope. It's all right. You don't worship men. You simply don't do it. You don't even worship angels. "Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshiping of angels." John tried to do it. "And I saw these things and heard them. And when I had heard and seen, I fell down to worship before the feet of the angel which showed me these things. Then saith he unto me, See thou do it not. For I am thy fellow servant, and of thy brethren the apostles, and of them which keep the sayings of this book, worship God." Even the angel said, no, you can't worship me. I serve God just like you do. The angels serve God in different contexts, but they still are servants of God. They can't be worshipped, and yet here we have groups that want to worship men. "The worship of images had stolen into the church by insensible degrees, and each petty step was pleasing to the superstitious mind, as productive of comfort and innocent of sin. But in the beginning of the 8th century, in the full magnitude of the abuse, the more timorous Greeks were awakened by an apprehension that under the mask of Christianity they had restored the religion of their fathers. They heard with grief and impatience the name of idolaters, the incessant charge of the Jews and Mohammedans, who derived from the law and the Quran an immortal hatred to graven images and all relative worship." So here they are. They've got all these paintings, statues, and all these things. And the Jews and the Muslims alike are pointing the finger at him and saying, "You're idolaters." And they were kind of looking around and saying, "Wait a minute, are we?" Of course, this was the time, if you think about it, when Islam, the Muslims, were sweeping through and looking at one point like they would overtake that entire part of the world. And, of course, they had no remorse whatsoever about destroying churches and persecuting people who worship images and idols. "The servitude of the Jews might curb their zeal and depreciate their authority, but the triumphant Muslims reigned at Damascus and threatened Constantinople, cast into the scale of reproach the accumulated weight of truth and victory. The cities of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt have been forfeited with the fortified with the images of Christ, his mother, and his saints, and each city presumed on the hope of promise of miraculous defense. In a rapid conquest of 10 years, the Arabs subdued those cities and these images. And in their opinion, the Lord of hosts pronounced a decisive judgment between the adoration and contempt of these mute and inanimate objects." That's exactly what happened. But certainly, the Muslims weren't serving him, but they were serving his purpose here. These people who claimed Christianity, they were idolaters. And he sent through a people who persecuted them. And people like us, they would pretty much ignore it. Yes, may have paid a little tax, but they would let us do what we wanted to, because we weren't doing anything that was that offensive to them. And if you ever care to look it up, this is from Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and he goes on page after page about idolatry and how rampant it was at that period of time. "But the hour cometh and now is when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth." We worship God, and we do it in spirit and in truth. We don't do it through things. We don't worship people. God has never commanded any Christians to build huge, expensive cathedrals, houses almost, and spend millions of dollars decorating it and commissioning all the sculptures, the paintings, and all this stuff. God doesn't want that. Find a universe that is far beyond anything man's hands can create. We look at artwork that men have done and we're amazed.
We ever stop around and look at what God has made? We can't even come close to it. God is not praised in the least by the work of men's hands. Neither repented they of their murders, nor their sorceries, nor their fornication, nor their thefts. Bishop's efforts were reinforced in the 13th century by special courts of inquiry set up by the papacy. It's talking about the murders. These courts, known as the Inquisition, were eventually introduced to most areas of Europe. But the earliest was the one established in the south of France after heresy and revolt had gripped that region. The main disturbance there was called the Albigensian heresy, after the cathedral town of Albi, where it started. At the request of Pope Innocent III, French nobles from the north cruelly suppressed the rebellion by 1226. But heresy smoldered even after this crusade against Albigensians was over. To snuff out the remaining embers, Innocent's successor, Pope Gregory IX, established the Inquisition as a permanent court for finding and trying heretics. The Pope's Grand Inquisitor was placed at Carcassonne in the south of France. He sent deputies, drawn chiefly from the new Dominican order, to the towns and cities of the area. In the public square of each place, the deputies would announce their mission, then call for people to testify regarding suspected heretics. In pursuing their inquiries, the deputies resorted to torture to wring confessions from uncooperative suspects, and they denied accused persons legal counsel and the right to call or confront witnesses. Proceedings were usually conducted in secret. Lucky prisoners would confess early, repent, and forfeit only their property. Those who proved stubborn or who lapsed again into heresy after repenting were excommunicated and turned over to the civil authorities for more severe punishment. Canon or church law forbade the clergy to take life, but the civil authorities felt no such inhibition. And because heresy was often associated with popular discontent or rebellion, the civil authorities regarded it as equivalent to treason and therefore set the penalty of death for convicted heretics. If a responsible official failed to apply that penalty, he himself was liable to excommunication and punishment. The most common means of execution was burning at the stake, a means that gave heretics a chance to make a final repentance as the flames reached higher and higher. They might then have time to beg for God's forgiveness and the salvation of their souls. But in no case would the fire be quenched. The body of a confirmed heretic was already forfeit. Procedures and penalties of the Inquisition appeared cruel and inhuman to modern minds. In the view of medieval churchmen, however, the end, rooting out heresy, justified the means. Even the angelic doctor of the church, Thomas Aquinas, held that extreme punishments were necessary to protect souls from the contamination of false beliefs. His was no doubt an honest argument, but the Inquisition was also open to the foulest abuses. To level the accusation of heresy became a convenient way of injuring or getting rid of personal enemies, and the accusers were never identified by the court. So it makes you mad, you run to the Inquisitor. I think Greg's been out worshiping demons. You know he's in prison, they've taken all his property, his family's on the street, if they're not in jail with him. If he confesses to it, you know, he might, you know, get off. If he doesn't confess to it, he's going to burn at the stake. Somebody who was good and honest of heart and would not confess something they hadn't done, if somebody accused them of something, they were probably going to die. And so how many innocent people, Christian or not, died because of this? And also, thefts. You're taking property of innocent people who've done nothing in many cases. It's been accused by somebody who had something against them. Sorceries. You think of witchcraft and magic. There's a lot of things in Catholicism that fit this. Take a little bit of water that the priests pray over. It's holy water. It has almost magic properties. You can do all sorts of things. The emblems of the cross, well, you can ward off demons and vampires and all kinds of things with it. I mean, we appreciate the cross, Christ dying there, and what that means to us. And we celebrate that every first day of the week. But to go around like, you know, a little figure of a cross that's got all these magic powers on those, that's ridiculous. And the Eucharist, what they call the Lord's Supper, they teach that as you partake of the bread and the fruit of the vine, it literally becomes blood and flesh. The blood and flesh of Jesus as you partake of them. That sounds like magic to me. all sorts of things in Catholicism. We can make a whole list here that could be labeled as sorceries. Fornication. Now, that quite often is used to refer to idolatry, in a larger sense. Moreover, he, Jehoram, king of Judah, made high places in the mountains of Judah, and caused the inhabitants of Jerusalem to commit fornication, and compelled Judah thereto. Now, you can't make a nation commit fornication literally. But if they were God's people, they were in that sense married to God, and they go worship some other god, that's like a man or a woman being unfaithful to their spouse. So it's spiritual fornication. And that type of reference is made all through the Old Testament. At one point, God even speaks of putting away or divorcing Israel because they've been unfaithful to him. And ultimately, that's what happened. They were taken away into captivity. Thefts. Again, taking property from people who have been accused of something and not when they're found guilty. There's also something else. The extraordinary power of the medieval church rested solidly on the trust of the people. The rich left the church generous gifts, and bishops and abbots thereby acquired vast properties in land, serfs, animals, and buildings. And don't you know they used every cent of that for the church and to help the poor and all this? Absolutely not. Says the bishops and abbots themselves acquired lots of stuff personally. Just given to the church, guess who ends up with it? The bigwigs. Corruption. These are supposed to be God's people. They're in it for themselves. And later on, when we get really looking at Catholicism in depth, there's a couple of passages I'm going to read you that hopefully will curl your hair, just how bad things were. So, that's that. So, despite God's warnings, Romans continue to be stubborn, refuse to repent. So all the people in this part of the world who've been part of the Roman Empire, they saw the empire dismantled, piece by piece by piece, and they wouldn't repent. The Roman Empire's gone. But again, this is chapter 9. There's 13 more chapters to go. We're not even halfway done. So what are we going to talk about for the rest of the time? Well, we're up to 1453. The empire's gone. But we had our back turned on Rome, didn't we? We weren't watching. And it turns out that about a half century, roughly 50 years after the Western Roman Empire ended, Rome was in the hands of Germans. People were Germanic, but something happened. Greater power has arisen there. That's where our story has got to turn to. This power would dominate Western Europe for over 1,000 years. And at one point, I think, was just about as powerful as the Roman Empire was. This was the power in that part of the world during the Dark Ages. And it's one, really probably the main reason that Europe remained in the Dark Ages. They were consolidating power. They didn't want anybody else to have it. Toward the city of Rome, that story is going to turn once again and really stay there. The last chapter of Revelation, where it gets a little more general again. Four facets of Rome that God has to deal with. Appreciate your attention this evening. If we can assist anyone, please come forward as we stand and say.